Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Nasiri, and my goal is to help military members thrive in their post-service career. Today's episode number 366. Now, normally I start with a nice quote and a couple of reasons to listen to the episode. I'm not going to do that today. Today is a conversation I should have had 300 episodes ago. It is a conversation I wish more people were having more candidly today. I sit down with Natasha Sistrunk Robinson, where we spend the bulk of our time discussing race and gender and the role it plays in the military and beyond. It is an open, honest, and very imperfect conversation, and something I sincerely hope you take the time to listen to. With that, let's dive in to my conversation with Natasha. Well, joining me today in Madison, Alabama, my guest and fellow Naval Academy 2002 graduate is Natasha Sistrunk Robinson. Natasha, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Glad to be here, Justin. Thank you for having me.
And so for listeners, I chatted with Natasha for all of 2 minutes right before we started recording, and she was open to me just kind of clicking record and doing things a little bit different today. And that is, I'll give listeners and Natasha some background on reaching out. So I saw, I believe Natasha posted on Facebook to a 2002 Naval Academy page, and she was posting about her book. And I reached out immediately and said, hey, would you come on the show? And it simultaneously ordered her book on Amazon, which I'm holding up right now, which you can't see because you're listening to this. But part of where the desire to reach out was first of all, Natasha, as we'll get into, has a pretty different background. This is episode 366, I believe, and it's different than many of the stories that I've heard of her paving her own way. But second, I was reading at the time a book called White Fragility, which if that title is painful to hear, it was painful for me to hear. I think one of the things I was taking away when I was reading that book was the painful realization of the blind spots that I have around race, around gender, around religion, just starting to realize like, oh, I you know, picture myself like many people as saying, oh, like, oh, I'm not racist or I'm open-minded or all of these things. And that book does an incredible job of just dissecting the bullshit of that statement of I'm not racist, and starting to shine a flashlight on all of the ways in which many of us are unaware of our implicit bias and all of the ways in which we have such different experiences growing up. And so that was also when I saw Natasha talking about her book. The one that I'm holding up is called A Sojourner's Truth, which is not her first book. It's her third book. But I really appreciate from what I've read so far, her willingness to talk about a lot of these things. And I also want to own for Natasha, for myself, and for our listeners, there's a lot of fear in even having this conversation. Like I notice my own fear of like, oh, I'm going to say something wrong, or I'm going to offend Natasha, or I'm going to offend our listeners, or our listeners won't want to hear this, or whatever it is. And I think it's important to name that fear because I think that's part of this process of bringing curiosity and having a dialogue, even if the dialogue is imperfect. And so I'm going to just read really quickly Natasha's background, and then Natasha, I'll give you some white space because I know I've been talking a lot here, and this is the first we've really had a conversation about this. But just for listeners, so you know, and I'm reading this from the back of her book, A Sojourner's Truth. Natasha Sistrunk Robinson is an international speaker, leadership consultant, mentoring coach, and the visionary founder of the nonprofit Leadership Links, Inc. She is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and a former Marine Corps officer. She is also the author of Mentor for Life and Hope for Us. And hopefully we'll get into all of those things. But let me just take a breath, Natasha, and I'll give you space to chime in on whatever comes up for you.
Yeah, I think just as a matter of introduction, again, thank you for, I guess, a few things. One, for the invitation. And I think especially where we are right now in as a country and in the world, intentionally having diverse conversations is really going to be the thing that helps move us forward as a people. And so I want to thank you for setting a table for that, being hospitable in that, being open to that. So I think that's very important. But I also want to acknowledge, you're naming the fear. So one of the things you'll see on my book, for those who actually get the chance to see the cover, is called A Sojourner's Truth. But truth is like the biggest word there, because obviously from our background, at the Naval Academy, there are character and core values and principles that we were, trained to live by. And one of them is honor, courage, and commitment, right? And so it takes courage sometimes to confront and be honest about very hard things. And so I appreciate you naming the fear, the concern, because I think we need to be honest about those things and not allow those things to paralyze us, to cripple us from moving forward, but really to be courageous to move forward in light of that fear. So I wanted just to speak that. And that's a good start.
And let me just pile on that, since I appreciate you're making it safe to air these fears. When I was thinking about this conversation this week, typically that these interviews are mostly the same. It's, let's talk about your career, and I want to do that today. And then I started double guessing myself, where I wanted to also use this as a conversation for curiosity around race and gender and these things that make massive roles. But the voice in the back of my head was like, you don't want to treat someone else differently. Like, if I treat this conversation differently, that almost feels wrong. It's almost like, well, does that make sense? There's like this fear of like, there was the fear of like treating it differently, but then there was also the excitement and realization of like, we can have this conversation. And also, as I was reading your book, realizing how much of a gift this interview is, because you've already in your book talked about these things so openly and, in my view, so boldly and beautifully, kind of put stakes in the ground of not pulling punches about your experience and not holding back on a lot of the things that were painful to read that you have gone through in your life that I haven't experienced.
Sure. Yeah, and I think what you get, especially when you're dealing with people who come from a people group that is more communal, which I do. So I'm Black, I'm African American. I was born that way. I'm gonna die that way, right? That's not changing. And so to some extent, just my very presence enters in a new reality to a space.
Yep.
And quite frankly, as a professional, that's almost always my reality. So, when I went to the Naval Academy, when I went into the Marine Corps, when I go to a corporate space, when I go to a classroom at a seminary, a university, a college, almost always, because I'm already at a certain tier of leadership, because of my experience, my professionalism, my academic background, I'm in a space where I'm often one or only, pick your thing, right? I'm often one of very few or only women. I'm one of very few Black people. I'm one of very few people of color. And so to some extent, this just reflects the reality of how we move in the social constructs that we have in our society. And I submit that for that to not continue to be the reality, we have to be aware that that is reality. So for you, you said like, this is, I don't want to treat this as different. But for me, unfortunately, it's the norm.
Mm-hmm. It is different. Like that is the reality. Different. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's interesting. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe, continuing off script here. One thing that comes up for me is, you and I were classmates at the Naval Academy. I don't think we really knew each other. I'm wondering for me or for other listeners, what do you want us to know about your experience at the Naval Academy that we might not have realized, or that might have been different than my experience. If that does that make sense? It's kind of like, yes. What do I not know,
right,
that I took for granted, or yeah.
So it's very interesting. So this book released a couple of years ago, and of course, with everything is happening in our country, particularly with the social unrest, specifically regarding race, and the ways that Black bodies are treated publicly in our society, that has caused a resurgence in people asking questions, reading books or whatever. And so my nonprofit, we just wrapped up the conversation last night. We wanted to take that as an opportunity to put this book on the table as a conversation piece. And quite frankly, it was written that way, to be a conversation piece. So this is a book that you can, you know, have in a book club. You can have it with your family at a dinner table. You can have it, you know, you can use it depending on your workspace as, you know, a leadership training conversation with administrators. You can have it with a small group or a Bible study at your church. And so it's meant to be used in that way, particularly because my interactions with people, both personally and professionally, is very diverse. And so I was conscious of that. And so in sharing this book over the last couple of months to say this book discussion is coming, I've shared it with several Naval Academy groups. Here's the thing. So I graduated, you know, as you know, in 2002, did 3 years at Camp Lejeune, 3 jobs there in the Marine Corps. Then I went back to the Naval Academy to work. So I did my last 3 years in the Corps as the Diversity Outreach Officer at the Naval Academy and Office of Admissions. So I spent another 3 years, you know, at our great alma mater beyond the time of being a student there. And then I left that job to go do other professional works in various career fields. And so in sharing the book with these Naval Academy groups and communities, I've had some alumni purchase it and start reading it. And I've gotten some messages from those people. And one of the women that messaged me was actually a classmate who I didn't remember. You know, we weren't really close friends. I didn't remember. But she said to me, Natasha, you know, I'm a few chapters into your book. And the second chapter, I write about the loss of my mother. So my mother passed away first semester of our sophomore year. And so it was it's 2 weeks before Christmas. Which is around exam time, as you know. So I missed exams to go home for my mother's funeral. Then I came back from a funeral, took exams, and went home to what was supposed to be a Christmas holiday celebration. And so this person emailed me. She said, Natasha, I remember us coming out of English class and you telling me, you know, that your mother had passed away and how great of a mother she was and how great of a relationship you had. She said, I didn't inquire anymore because I was too wrapped up in my own stuff. She said, and I am so sorry about that. And she's saying, in reading this, I regret that I didn't get a chance to know you better at school. And so I responded to her and, you know, thanked her for the words of encouragement and, you know, that statement. You know, she didn't have to email me or whatever, and told her, you know, thanked her for buying a book because she didn't have to do that either. Right. And so I just think that I say that as a foundation for this. I believe the Naval Academy is a hard institution for everybody, and it should be. I think it's hard for different reasons. And so I want to acknowledge that. I think it's very challenging place. And one of the things people joke about, I don't know if you've heard this, but one thing I've heard for a long time, the Naval Academy is not a great place to be. It's a great place to be from.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. And so, I've witnessed that. And that's, you know, that's regardless of gender, regardless of race or whatever. But my reality, my social location meant that I was a woman, that I was Black, that I was from the South, a small rural town in the South, that I was from a family that did not have a lot of academic means. So depending on the year, you know, we were lower middle class or poor, depending on, you know, and not poor in that we never miss meals, but poor in that we didn't have a lot left over after the bills were paid. And so, and it was not for my parents' lack of hard work or them not, you know, it was just the reality of our situation. And so I come to the Naval Academy for a few things, a few, you know, with a few understandings, a few postures and principles, if you will. Number one, I come from a patriotic family. So my mother served in the Army. She was a typist because that's what women did when my mother got into the Army. So she's a veteran. Her father served in the Army. He served in World War II. So he's a war, you know, war veteran. Her brother served in the Army. And at the time that I was considering going into the military, on my dad's side, I had four, one of his sisters has four boys, and we are, you know, I'm like somewhere in the middle of them. Three of those four boys enlisted in the military, two Marines and one Air Force. So I come from a patriotic family, and I don't feel that I have to say that for justification, but I want to say that because a lot of the conversations we end up having, I think we get distracted by conversations that are not important or the right ones. And so one of the distractions when we start addressing race issues, you know, whether it's Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, one of the distractions is what is not patriotic. And so I will speak clearly and say that is a lie and a narrative that we have to correct, mm-hmm. right? If you indeed love something, you have a responsibility. If you are a parent, you know this, to challenge and correct so you can get the best out of that thing or that person that you love, if it is your responsibility. And I believe as American citizens, it is all of our responsibility. So that's number one. I come from a patriotic family, and I come from a community, I know you've read some of this already, of advocates, right? So in my hometown, there was a massacre of young people, you know, this is high school students from my high school that were doing a nonviolent protest to desegregate a bowling alley that legally was supposed to already be desegregated. And so three young men, not young men, I call them boys. I think it's important that, you know, they're teenagers, 17, 18 year old boys were murdered because they wanted to bowl, right? And these were boys from my high school. And these were stories I heard coming up. One of my aunts was one of the first people to stand in line so Black people can have a right to vote in our county. So I come from a history and a culture and a community of people who want to stand for justice. And what I mean by that is just to do what's right. And that's beyond, you know, the national leaders that we know, Congressman John Lewis that we just buried yesterday, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Reverend C.T. Vivian that we buried last week, and so many other women of the civil rights movement that we don't name, Ella Baker, Prathia Hall, Ida B. Wells, you know, so many of these, Fannie Lou Hamer, Coretta Scott King, in addition to Rosa Parks. So there's a history of that in me. And so that's a kind of just a character fight that I brought to the Naval Academy, right? And then the last part of that was I did not want to be, I didn't want my parents to have to worry about me. I'm the oldest of three children. I didn't want them to have to worry about me. And I wanted to be able to financially support myself. So part of my reason for choosing the Naval Academy, and I want to say this, Justin, because the perception then as a student, and even when I was on the Board of Admissions, and even now as we, you know, had our little Board of Trustees situation a few weeks ago that you've heard about, is that somehow the Black and brown people, the minority people that get into the Naval Academy have not gotten in on their own merit. So I'm a person that, when I got accepted to the Naval Academy, I had been accepted to multiple other schools. I had multiple full rides to other schools. I had full rides to other schools that didn't require me to go an extra year, which I did because I went to the Naval Academy Preparatory School. And I turned down those offers to go to the Naval Academy, right? So I had options. I chose the Naval Academy. And part of the reason for choosing the Naval Academy, in addition to the patriotic piece, was they were going to pay me to go to school, in addition to giving me a free education. And they were going to give me a career, because I saw that they were college students or college graduates. I would look around that weren't working at the time. And it didn't make sense to me to go to school and pay money and not have a job that could sustain my family. And that's the reality of many Americans, right? That they're working and they're not getting a fair wage, that they're going to school, they have so much debt, and then the job they get is not sustainable to pay the debt or to take care of their families. And I started to understand that just by observing people at 18. And so part of my decision to go to the Naval Academy is like, I didn't want that to be my reality. I wanted to be able to graduate school with a great degree that was going to mean something without debt, and I have a job. So those were the practical things. I share that because when I got to the academy, I had every intention of graduating, period. Right. And so when all the games, and this is my personal experience, there were games, right? There were games in plebe to try to run me out, which I wrote about in the book. There were games, you know, not, there were games in plebe summer. There was pressure throughout plebe year to quit. And the people who were putting on that pressure, you know, didn't know me. They didn't know me. They only knew what they thought about people who looked like me. And so that was on them. But for me, I came with a mission, and my mission was to graduate. And that's what I came to do. And that's what I did. And so it was hard, you know, mostly I think there were more challenges regarding race than gender for me, but because I am a woman, I had enough conversations with women and observations with women to know that there were challenges for being women as well. And I think there's just a challenge of, you know, being in such a large space where the norm, not everyone, but the norm is white, the norm is male, the norm is elite. And so there were so many things that, and when I say elite, I mean privilege as far as people having access and opportunities to things that, Justin, I didn't even know about. So I'm here just trying to learn, and I'm looking at people are getting introduced to new opportunities to continue building wealth and legacy for their families. And I'm glad for the $50 they gave me, you know, every month, freshman year, so I can perhaps get a burger, fries, and go to a movie twice a month. That was my reality.
I love so much of what you're saying. There's a lot to unpack here, but I'll start by just saying it's so difficult for me to hear that race was more difficult for gender, because as I entered this conversation, you know, as I reflect on my 18 years since graduating, and I think back to, with a lot of shame from my own experience, of all of the incredibly, I'll just own my for myself, all the incredibly sexist things that I did, in the jokes that I told, the jokes that I laughed at, the complete way in which I objectified women, which was at the time 15% of my class. And it was a very tremendously, in my view, my experience was tremendously, in retrospect, incredibly caustic environment. It's difficult for me to imagine what it was like for my female classmates. And then for that to be my perspective, and to realize that your experience was like, the gender piece was not even on the radar, like the race was a cut deeper. And I think that's one of the things I appreciated about your book is, let's start with your mother. And I'm thinking, okay, my sophomore year in college, had my mother passed away, I would have been devastated, as I know that you were. And that likely would have been the extent of my experience, the devastation for my loss. I would have no fear for my father. I would have no fear for my brothers. I would feel no obligation to any of them. It would be basically me processing my grief. And the impression I got from your book is that on top of that, you're assuming the matriarch position in your family, and it is not you needing to just take care of yourself. You're having to think about how you're going to look after your immediate and your extended family, which is a burden I've never felt. And that's mm-hmm. part of your experience, which is, it's so difficult to get my head around being, what, 19 years old and having to assume that mantle of leadership and responsibility. It doesn't even factor into my thinking now. And I've got a son. It's just like, it's very, very difficult to comprehend that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And if I can pick up the gendered piece, and this is a teaching point, right? Of when, first of all, thank you for your honest confession. I believe that the truth should set us free. Hmm. So, you know, because then there's no game, you know, no shame and guilt in it. You know, shame and guilt paralyzes. It doesn't make us better. And so I think it's important to, again, keep naming those things. And so, you know, I would say and suspect that in the objectification of women, you know, the target of that most often was white women, right? And so the reality of brown women in our country, and this is part of the problem too that we see, is that they're invisible, right? Like, you're not even looking at them. So when we have an Ahmaud Arbery or a George Floyd, you know, that can escalate and get a response nationally, but Breonna Taylor's murderers are still, you know, hanging out and getting paid to work. And so, and you know, again, she's the latest, you know, just a couple, last year I was speaking at a school and, you know, a black woman, Tatiana Jefferson, was murdered by the state, playing video games in her home with her nephew in the middle of the night, in her own home, you know. Before that, you know, there's just list after list. And so I think it's important to name the ways that Black and brown women, and I mean specifically African-American, Latino women, indigenous women even, are ignored in our society. And so I think that's one of the very real things here. And so if at any point they raise their voice, they make noise, they are labeled, you know, words that are not very pleasant, or they are angry, or they're difficult to work with, or negative. Instead of saying, what is going on here that prompts that response in the first place? I think that's very important. And then the communal aspect of it that you mentioned is very real too. And so I think the positive I want to share here is because of those realities of the community that I had at the academy was with Black women. It was with Black women. And it's because of the communities that I cultivated primarily with those Black women that I was able to move forward in times that were very, very difficult. I mean, even today, and I'm sure you can attest to, like, some of my closest friends in life are Black women that I met or interact with in some way at the Naval Academy. Like, my four or so closest friends are that way. And so these were environments that we cultivated in the gospel choir, right? And so that was where the light was for me. Like, every Tuesday, we're going to gospel choir. And here's the thing, all of us kind of had those similar challenges of family. You know, we all had those similar challenges of family. We had, again, Naval Academy worries and academic worries and swim worries and sports worries. But yes, we were carrying the worries of our family because we were privileged for many of us to be first generation, or maybe we weren't first generation, but certainly there was an expectation, and not that we had to do something or show up any particular way for our family, but that when we did well, that our families and our communities would benefit, because we are a communal people. And so, yes, I came back from that devastating thing. And part of the unhealthiness of a Naval Academy environment is that there is no room, really, and you can probably attest to this, to do anything, right? They tell you how you're going to do, how you're going to live, what you're going to do. And so there was really no room to properly grieve in a healthy way. Because I came back, and then there was exams, and then you got the new semester. Like, you don't get weeks off, right? It's not like maternity leave, right? You come back and you have work to do. And quite frankly, it's a very unhealthy thing, but there was not an alternative to it. And so, you know, you came back and you try as best you can to focus on your responsibility, because it is a responsibility. And because of my faith, I had a strong faith community that was able to, you know, check in, you know, on me and provide the space for those conversations and prayer and, you know, crying and those things. And then I think, you know, the friendship circles that I had was very helpful to just bear. You know, I think I read in a book something like this, that sometimes God provides people in your life to make your tragic lives bearable. Mm-hmm. And that's where I had, you know, I had wonderful, I still have beautiful people in my life that make, you know, very difficult situations bearable.
It's so interesting to hear that, because I'm trying to put myself back in my 18-year-old Naval Academy, like kind of steeped in this environment. And I know at the time I would look at any minority grouping, right? You have all of these clubs and things like that. I know the story I would have said at the time is, this is such bullshit. I'm friends with everyone. Why can't they just fit in? Mm-hmm. And what I hear in your experience is the lifeline of like having people who I certainly at the time didn't understand your experience. And I would even say, I don't understand now your experience. And so the aspect of being around that lifeline of people who understand what you are uniquely going through. And I think what comes through as well, when you said that about the objectification of white women, which I'll admit is true for me, is I know the pain of not being seen and not being heard. Like, that's like, in some ways, for me, that pain is more profound than being singled out. Like, the pain of being overlooked, mm-hmm. and not heard or seen or understood is such a deep cut. And to just even, I didn't even realize that until you said that, of like, oh yeah, even the objectification only went so far. And it was completely ignoring a large population. And it's like the subconscious writing off as of like unworthiness of attention, like unworthiness of notice. It's just, there's so much in what you're saying that hadn't occurred to me before.
Yeah.
One thing that stood out from your book, and you touched on this a little bit, but this bowling alley in your hometown, and I would love for you to kind of expand on that and the impact it had on your worldview at a very young age, because it's very, again, very different from my own experience. But could you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and I'm the worst. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm the worst with like dates and names and things, but I'll give you the basic premise of it. So it is the Orangeburg Massacre. Orange, like the orange you would eat, or the color Orangeburg, B-U-R-G. So you can look it up. I mean, there's stuff online available to it. And some of our civil rights museums and stuff now are starting to actually share more about it, because I, you know, again, we think about civil rights and we you know, we talk about Montgomery, we talk about Selma. They're very, you know, they're very specific events that we talk about, and not understanding that this uprising for justice and equality was happening all over the country. And so this was one of the ways, and I, you know, I'm glad we've been reminded over the last couple of weeks too, that this civil rights movement for Black people against the I would call it the injustice of Jim Crow was by and large a young people's movement, right? These were teenagers, and we're seeing some of that happening again in our country, but these were teenagers. You know, when Congressman John Lewis started to follow, be mentored by Dr. Martin Luther King, he was 14, 15 years old. You know, Dr. King, young 30 something when he got murdered. I think we forget how young these people are. And so when I contrast like the reality of like the Orangeburg massacre to say a place where I just previously lived in the Greensboro, North Carolina area, where the sit-in started at the Woodworth counter, where my godmother, who was the gospel choir director at the Naval Academy, she was going to college there at Bennett College, which is a historically Black college and university, all-girls school, and participated in those sit-ins and got arrested for participating in those sit-ins. So many of them got arrested, like they did not have room to hold them in the jail. So they would put them in other buildings in the city because they were arresting all these college students that had trained themselves and disciplined themselves for peaceful protests so that they can have their rights met. And then when they arrested all of those, they pulled the high school students from Dudley High School to follow behind them. And those high school students started to sit in at the counters and sometimes get arrested. And so that was happening at the same, so the same thing you're seeing happening there in North Carolina was happening in a small town like mine in South Carolina, where college students, so I come from a college town. There's two historically Black colleges and universities there, two HBCUs, Claflin University and South Carolina State University. And one of them is a private school, one of them is a state institution. And those students between those two campuses, which are right next door to each other, really started to organize these peaceful protests. And so there's this bowling alley in town, kind of like downtown in the center of town. It is the only bowling alley within a 20-mile radius. And it's supposed to be desegregated, but it's owned by, you know, a white man, last name Floyd, I believe. But again, check the book because I'm the worst with names and dates and things. But he owned the bowling alley and basically like, over my dead body, will this happen? And so they start peaceful protests, you know, goes on for days. Things escalate quickly. Again, high school students from my high school, Orangeburg Wilkerson High School, start to participate at this point. You know, we got federal troops coming in. You know, again, we're seeing some of this now, right? Like, so what starts out as a small nonviolent city issue, now you got SWAT coming in. And the town is so small. When I left Orangeburg, we didn't have a Walmart to tell you how small my town is. That's how small it is, okay? And so, you know, you got SWAT coming in, you got federal officers coming in. They're violently affronting American citizens, you know, for exercising their right to protest. And so as a result of all of that, you have, you know, these three boys that are murdered. And I knew about them. And this is why I knew about them, Justin, because by the time I was, you know, a middle school, the bowling alley had been closed for years. So the bowling alley was never open where I could remember when I was a child. So it had been closed for years. And so you have like this abandoned storefront where the bowling alley was one of the stores that was in the storefront. And so what was in that window, though, was the Black and white images of the young men, Delaney, Sam, and Henry, that had been murdered. And so it was like a memorial there. And that's what I knew. That's what I knew. I knew the marquee that remained hanging up, even though the bowling alley was closed, and I knew the Black and white images in the window. And so that's a story that I've been told. It's a story that I carried with me. It wasn't until many years later, matter of fact, probably within the last 5 years, I'm in Greensboro at the Civil Rights Museum, the International Civil Rights Museum there, and I'm reading and find that a Black woman. I feel like her name is Kimberly, but she was a college student. She was married, a college student, and pregnant, and got beaten by a cop during that massacre, and lost her baby. And so count that as a loss of human life as well. Because she lost her baby within a week of being physically assaulted by a cop. And so, you know, that's just, it's just one of those things, again, one of several stories throughout my life where I've seen Black people try to stand up for their own dignity. And I think the issue is that it doesn't matter in our country how Black people have done that, the response is still the same. It's still violence. The answer is often no. And the accusation of why it is that we behave the way that we do.
Just, I'm comparing experiences and I'm thinking, you know, my own upbringing, and then I'm imagining what it must be like to go by a location like that on a daily basis and to see that, and the way that that would formulate my view towards authority, the way that would view, that would affect my view of the police, right? Like my experience was, I get pulled over. It's not a big deal. I'm not, I have no reason to fear. I have no reason to, have any worries. It's just crazy to me to think of all of the ways that that would affect my view of everything, because that's my experience.
Yeah, and I think the thing, I want to say this because I think it's important. My unique experience too, and this is, you know, I attribute it to, you know, God's kind of path and direction. Again, my experience have been pretty diverse. And so, yes, I have witnessed, observed those, know those stories, you know, and my father is Black and I'm married to a Black man and I have a brother who's Black and, you know, a lot of Black men that I know, and I know their stories, right? And so that's a reality that I've known and contended with throughout life. And yet, you know, the flip side of that, and this is kind of part of the problems that we see, that one of my godparents growing up was a Black man who was the sheriff of the police in our community. And he was the track coach for my football team when I ran Junior Olympics. And so the difference between when you have police who are in the community and they serve the community and they have relationship with the community and there's a mutual respect between them and the people that they serve versus people who are hired that don't know the people that they serve, that don't have relationship with the people that they serve, that drive in and out of the communities that they serve. You know, that's a completely different reality. And so as a child, I wouldn't say that I had a fear of the police as a Black girl. Now, there may have been some Black boys in my community that had a fear of the police. But as a child, I didn't have that fear because my godfather was the sheriff of police. And because I had a relationship with him and because I knew many police officers, and those police officers were active in the community doing all kinds of wonderful, positive things because they were Black and their families were a part of the communities in which they served.
I love it. And I'm appreciating the clarity on that and just also honoring the, You share in your book about a lot of just a lot of, whether it's the loss of your daughter, the loss of your mother, just a lot of the pain that you have experienced in life and what you have learned and the example that you are to others in the book and in your life of perseverance and learning and resilience is really powerful. I do want to shift gears a little bit because I'm cognizant of the time here. Let's maybe talk about if you ran into on the streets today another Marine Corps veteran, and they said, "Natasha, so what do you do for a living these days?" I imagine this is a particularly hard question for you, but how do you answer that?
Yeah, I'm kind of like a social entrepreneur. And I'm just kind of learning to accept that now, because I do have my hands in quite a bit of things. And so people who, you know, maybe don't know me or not familiar with me personally or my work, it may look like she's doing a lot of things. But for me, actually, it centers on really like probably two things, leadership and faith. Those are probably the two things that motivate all the work that I do. And so I cultivate personal, professional networks and relationships, but my work, what I get paid to do, Justin, to your point, because we talked about your work, what I get paid to do is leadership consulting. So I actually have a business, T3 Leadership Solutions. So you can do T3LeadershipSolutions.com. I do leadership consulting. I do leadership coaching. I do mentoring. And so some of that includes diversity, equity, inclusion work. So that's what I get paid to do. I also get paid to write. So I'm a writer. I write articles, essays, books, whatever. And most of that is my faith work. And I do speaking. And so I speak in, you know, very diverse communities and environments. So the speaking kind of overflows out of the writing. And so I get paid for that too. And to some extent, you know, depending on the audience and community, that's ministry in addition to work. And then I have my 501c3 nonprofit, which is straight up community service. And that's Leadership Links Incorporated. And the beautiful thing about that, Justin, you will appreciate, is that I started that 501c3 with, counting myself, 6 Naval Academy graduates, all African American graduates. And so this is where we invest our time and our resources and our services to really cultivate a community of like-minded people who are serving the people in the communities that God has called them to. But, you know, we are intentionally raising up the next generation of leaders through that nonprofit as well. So we provide leadership education that's holistic in that space.
What I'm most admiring, apart from the diversity of everything you're doing, is how you have these, you know, leadership and faith as these pillars that for you unify what to me, from an external standpoint, seemed like, wow, she's like really playing the drums. She's got everything going on. And I think that's a great example for listeners to, when you can pinpoint those driving values, you can do quite a bit of things that might seem unrelated, but they're unified because you have clarity on the things that matter to you most. On the writing, is that something, have you always written? Was that something from a young age, or when did that start to emerge for you?
So it's very interesting you should ask. So I've always been a reader. Like growing up as a kid, I was the one, I never knew what was going on around me because I always had my head in a book. So that's just what's my reality. So I've always loved to read. And as you know, leaders are readers and readers are leaders. And also I found now in hindsight that people who read well, write well. Mm. So I've always been a reader. And then I go to the Naval Academy thinking that I'm going to do something in engineering because everyone told me that I was smart. And that's what smart people do. Like you either become a lawyer, doctor, or engineer. And I didn't want to be a doctor or engineer. So I figured I'll do the engineering. I mean, I didn't want to be a doctor or lawyer. So I figured I'd do the engineering thing. Then I got to the Naval Academy. It's like, oh, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. Not interested in that. And so I majored in English for two reasons. One, because I wanted to graduate on time. And two, because I love to read and write. And so I really learned how to cultivate my thoughts, you know, in that English department, not knowing, because I did not aspire to become a writer. It was not a part of my career goals, wasn't on my vision board or my bucket list. It wasn't on my radar to do at all. But I majored in English because I enjoy reading, writing. I wanted to graduate. So that's what I did. And years passed, you know, as a matter of fact, I remember specifically, I was working at the Department of Homeland Security. My boss was a Naval Academy graduate. And she said to me, because I wasn't sure about whether I was going to make the federal government a career once I got out. So we were married, had a little girl, we were in the thick of Iraq war, and I wanted to be with my daughter. So I got out and I took this job, and I wasn't sure if I was going to do a career in the federal government. And she said, use this as your transition job, figure out what you really want to do. And in the midst of that, Justin, I started to wake up in the middle of the night with all these words, like I couldn't sleep. That was like flooding over. And I started writing. That was in 2010. So now I've published probably 130 articles and, you know, three book projects. I have another book project under contract. And that's how that writing thing happened. Just kind of one book led to another book, led to another book. So I know when I can't sleep and I have the words, it's time to write a book.
I love that, because I'm just thinking of myself and probably many others turning over at night, and you acting on that, you writing. And do you have any advice for anyone in our audience who aspires to write? I imagine it's very difficult to see through a project like that. Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for aspiring writers?
Yeah, you need to know what you're writing for. Like, everything that you write does not need to be published. So, you know, some people write and journal for mindfulness and clarity and reflection. I'm the worst at journaling, but that's what you know for. And I remember one of my professors saying, some people only have one book in them, some people only have one blog post. And so I think we're in a society a lot where people are striving for things, and it's like, I'm definitely going to write another book, because I know what that is, but I'm not going to write just to write. So know why you're writing, and know that not everything that's written needs to be published. But if you want to write for publication, then you need to understand that it takes the cultivation of the skill of writing, which means you need to write consistently. That's one of the reasons I started blogging. I just needed to write. I wanted to practice the discipline of writing every day, or challenging myself to write and have something to hold me accountable to writing, because it's easy to not write with everything else that I have going on.
What was your goal with blogging? Was it like a blog post a week, or what was that? What kind of motivated you?
I started blogging in 2010. I don't even blog it. I still have the blog. What's my blog? A Sister's Journey. SISTA'S. A Sister's Journey is the blog. I don't write as consistently, but it's still there, and all the content is there. But when I wrote initially, I think I had, you know, two or three times a week. I had a goal. So have a goal, and the goal was to challenge me to write. And I was writing because, again, I wanted to practice a discipline of it. I didn't really care if people read it or not. I was really just doing it as a discipline, and I was instructed to do that by a mentor as well. So you write, and then if you're writing to publish, meaning you're interested in having a book and those type things, then the thing I was going to say to wrap that up is, you have to understand that there is very much the element of just writing well, good quality writing. That's part of it. But then you become an entrepreneur. You know, it becomes a business. And there's a business side of writing that you have to learn, like getting a literary agent, right? And understanding how publishing houses work, and understanding that not every publisher publishes everything. And so I encourage you to, if that's your aspiration, to start looking for, there are a lot of literary agents that have blogs. And there are a lot of resources online about how to write a good book proposal, because you need a good book proposal to get considered for a literary agent. A literary agent is like a gatekeeper for publishing houses. So most publishers will not accept unsolicited material. So they use kind of literary agents as gatekeepers for that. And so you land a literary agent, and then your literary agent becomes the person that markets your project to different publishers.
Beautiful. Well, I want to just end with two questions. And for listeners, I'll put in the show notes at beyondtheuniform.org links to T3 Leadership, Leadership Links, everything we've talked about, the blog. But the two final questions are, first of all, if listeners are interested in supporting you, how can they do that? And then second of all, anything we didn't cover that you want to make sure listeners know before we wrap up?
Yeah, sure. Let me share just a quick personal note, because I think if we all want to move forward and be better and intentional in that, it's a kudos to you. and a challenge to your listeners, that when you have a table, when you have a space, that you can open that space and offer that table an opportunity, and you haven't lost anything. You haven't lost anything, right? And I think it's important because I think some of the conversations we have these days around diversity and equity and inclusion, we feel that if somehow that group gets what they're asking for, then we're going to lose something. And one thing I can tell you clear, Justin, for you to noodle on after we get done here, there are benefits certainly that I have for being a Naval Academy graduate. Like when I tell people I'm a Naval Academy graduate, they don't ask me any questions. But I will also tell you, I do not have the benefits that a white man has from graduating from the Naval Academy. I do not have the networks. I don't have the pay. I don't have the opportunity, right? And that's a very real thing. And so when we have people that have these, you know, these relationships, these opportunities, these financial resources, that they are saying, how can we in our actions provide more equity, you know, in our daily dealings personally, but more so systemically and professionally. So that's a challenge I want to leave with you and your readers. And then how to contact me. You have the business thing. So T3 is where I do all of my leadership consulting, those type works, the diversity, equity, inclusion work. And for those who are interested in my faith and ministry work, you can just look up my ministry page, which is different, natashasrobinson.com, S is in sistrunk. And then where, and so that's where you can find all the books, you know, the podcast, the blog, the social media followings, all that stuff is there. And then lastly, for my 501c3, Leadership Links Incorporated, is really where Leadership Links, L-I-N-K-S, stands for our core values of love, inspiration, network, knowledge, and service. Leadership Links, Inc., INC.org is where you can find us there. So right now, we are offering youth programming for middle and high school girls, but we're offering all kinds of programming for our intergenerational multi-ethnic community. And one of them has been this month, we just completed the book discussion of this book. So you can find that on our social media followings on YouTube, as well as our Facebook page. But we are coming up on our 5-year anniversary this month in August. And so we will have a lot to share of campaign and looking for, really, we need to get our nonprofit to a place of sustainability and still be able to maintain the integrity of our work. And so we will be asking people to partner with us in that. And so we would love to have that support.
Perfect. And I'll have links in that in the show notes. Natasha, thank you for your time. Thank you for your work. And thank you for sharing your story with Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you so much, Justin. Appreciate it.
Beyond the Uniform is written and produced by me, Justin Nasiri, with help from our Chief of Staff, Steve Bain, our editor, Kathleen Dillon, and our Head of Social Media, Janelle Hanf. We are an all-volunteer organization and would greatly appreciate your help in any of the following three ways. First of all, spread the word. Beyond the Uniform has over 360 podcast episodes and 15 on-demand webinars, all offered for free. Help us spread the word on social media, at military bases, or whatever gets the resource in front of the men and women who need it. Positive reviews on iTunes go a long way towards this as well. Second of all, sponsorship. Beyond the Uniform relies on financial sponsorship to keep us going. There is so much more we'd like to do as well, but just don't have nearly the resources to do so. If you know of a company that would advertise in any way with Beyond the Uniform, please send them our way. Third of all, donations. If you're in a financial position to donate, you can find more information on the support section of our website. At our website, beyondtheuniform.org, you'll find over 360 episodes categorized by industry, functional role, and more. You'll also find both free and for purchase resources that take a deeper dive on topics related to career growth. Thank you for your support as we aim to help members of the military community thrive in their post-military career and life.